Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Later this month, the U.S. will experience a total solar eclipse, but it won't be the same experience everywhere.
Here in Delaware, you know, the moon will cover 80% of the sun, which is a lot, but it's not going to make the really dramatic thing where, you know, day turns to night.
We talk everything eclipse with UD astronomy professor Dr. John Gieses. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about local historic preservation efforts in our latest History Matters, and have our second conversation with some of the 24 young African leaders at UD this summer, looking to learn ways to expand the work they do in their countries and deepen connections between the U.S. and Africa. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Depending on where you are August 21st, you may be able to look up at the sky during the day and see a total solar eclipse. Or you might know it's happening, but not see anything at all. So what is a total solar eclipse? And what will we be able to see from Delaware later this month? Delaware Public Media Science reporter Katie Pike has turned to University of Delaware astronomy professor Dr. John Gieses for answers.
Dr. Gieses, what is a total solar eclipse, and how do these kinds of things happen?
Well, from our point of view on Earth, if you are in the path of a total solar eclipse, what you'll see is the moon will pass directly in front of the sun and block its light for a few minutes. And so it will become dark like night. You will be able to see some faint gas maybe that surrounds the sun called the corona, but it only lasts a couple minutes. What's really happening is that when the moon passes directly between the Earth and sun, it has a shadow. And so the shadow is falling on Earth, and of course that makes it turn dark. But it's a fairly rare event for any given location on the Earth.
So it is a fairly rare event, as you just said, and it seems like there's a lot of hype about this particular one happening in August.
Yeah, because it's been quite rare for the total solar eclipses to be seen in the mainland of the U.S. I remember when I was a kid, it happened in 1979, and so they were saying that it was going to be many years until there was another total solar eclipse in the U.S., and so now all these years later, it's finally happening. So, you know, people will be able to see it without traveling a lot. Now, if you're into eclipses, of course, it happens somewhere on Earth several times a year usually. And so if you don't mind flying somewhere, you know, possibly on a plane over an ocean someplace, then you can see an eclipse if you're determined enough. But this will be, you know, accessible to millions of Americans who will just be able to step outside and see it.
So eclipses do happen several times a year, but the odds of an eclipse happening where you live or near where you live can be pretty low.
Yeah, so it turns out that the shadow, to get everything lined up perfectly so that you get a total solar eclipse, is only about 50 to 100 miles wide. So even though it traces out a long arc that maybe is 1,000 miles wide or more, you know, you have to be just in the right place.
And what will we be able to see from Delaware?
Now, many more people will see a partial solar eclipse. So here in Delaware, you know, the moon will cover 80% of the sun, which is a lot, but it's not going to make the really dramatic thing where, you know, day turns to night and getting the real total solar eclipse. You might not even notice anything was going on unless you observe the sun. And everyone always wants us to remind the public that you should never look at the sun directly during a partial solar eclipse or not an eclipse at all, unless you have, you know, very special glasses, not regular sunglasses, but what are called eclipse glasses that are very thick. They're kind of like welder's glasses, and they let hardly any light through, because otherwise it's very dangerous, and you can burn out your retina. So that'll be the main effect. The other thing that you can do is you can make a pinhole camera, and so if you make a hole in a piece of paper or something, the image of the sun will pass through the pinhole, and you'll be able to see that the moon is blocking part of it. And you can get instructions of how to make one online.
I might need to look into that. I'm also already looking into getting some glasses.
Yeah. You want to order them now, because they may be running short. But, of course, because of the eclipse and, you know, we've known it's coming, a lot of them have been made and a lot of companies have been distributing them.
And so even though this kind of eclipse is particularly rare, we've seen a few different kinds of eclipses over the last few decades or so. Do you personally have any stories about going to see an eclipse?
Well, I went to the 1991 total solar eclipse, partly because I was working in New Mexico at the National Solar Observatory. And at that time, the eclipse path first passed over Hawaii that year and then went into Mexico itself. So four of us jumped in a car, 20-year-olds not knowing what we're doing, and drove all the way through Mexico to the path of the eclipse, where we found a beach where everyone was set up to watch the eclipse, and people shared their telescopes, and it was a wonderful experience. It was certainly one of the most memorable things I've done in my life.
Yeah, and what was that like for you, seeing that?
Oh, I was amazed how dramatic it really is. You know, I'd seen partial eclipses, and I've seen lunar eclipses where, you know, where the moon turns dark because it's in the Earth's shadow. And those are not as exciting as a total solar eclipse. And the total eclipse, it really became dark. It was really as if night suddenly came. It cooled off very rapidly. I mean, you realized how much we depend on the sun for warmth, during the daytime. And, you know, you could even feel the wind rising because of the temperature differences all of a sudden. It was really very dramatic. And, of course, you know, through the telescope, which was, you know, properly equipped, of course, you know, you could see all these things that you can see in pictures, which is, you know, that there's this sort of bright gas surrounding the sun called the corona.
I am curious if there's any sort of, like, rising seas and climate change here on our Earth. Would that eventually affect our ability to see an eclipse?
I don't think the climate change would affect that. However, the moon is gradually getting further away from the sun. So over the course of thousands of years, the eclipses gradually get shorter. And so someday in the very, very distant future, there won't be total solar eclipses anymore because the moon will be further away and it will look smaller. It won't be big enough to block the sun. But none of us will. None of us have to worry about that.
And so eclipses gradually get shorter. How short is this one, and how does that compare to past eclipses?
This one, the total solar eclipse, depending on where you are, is sort of 1 or 2 minutes. And exactly how long they are depend on, you know, the details of the geometry and how fast the moon is going relative to the sun at that particular moment. And so the one I saw in Mexico was 7 minutes, which was, you know, sort of the longest of the century. I remember they were hyping it up as. But if you saw it in Hawaii, it was actually only 4 minutes long. And so whether it's 2 minutes long or 1 minute long depends on where you are in the U.S. for this particular eclipse. The partial eclipse lasts a long time. It takes a couple hours if you want to see, you know, just a little bit of the sun being blocked by the moon, like a little arc, then you're not quite so time sensitive.
But if you blink, you really could miss it, right?
Well, it's more than a blink, but yeah, absolutely. a cloud might come at just the wrong moment, right? And then it will still turn dark, and things will happen. But, you know, I think that would be, a little disappointing, you know, depending on how far you traveled.
That's true. And it really is weather dependent, right?
Well, absolutely. It's the same, you know, as seeing the sun, right? So if it's a foggy day and, you know, covered in rain, then, you know, it's not going to be that dramatic. You know, it'll still get dark and the moon will still block the sun, but it won't be quite the same experience, I don't think.
Gotcha. So on NASA's eclipse website, they say the last total solar eclipse viewed from a contiguous United States was on February 26th, 1979. And then after the August 2017 total solar eclipse, the next one in the United States will be October 14th, 2023, seen from Northern California to Florida. Then we'll have another one April 8th, 2024, Texas to Maine. I think one of those might be a partial eclipse here, but I'm wondering if you have anything to say about, you know, the frequency of what we'll see, you know, after this year.
Yeah, the April 2024 is a very promising one, as you said, right? It starts in Mexico and comes up through Texas and through Maine. I talked with one of the other people at the University of Delaware, and it goes over his mother's house in Indiana. So this eclipse is sort of 50 miles away from his mother's house, and the next eclipse goes right over it. So they're very lucky. Overall, you know, the eclipses do have a kind of pattern to them, and every 18 years the cycle kind of repeats but move to a different part of the Earth due to the way that things time. So there can be, you know, periods of time where we get very few eclipses and then periods where we get more. but over time it all averages out. I read that NASA calculated that if you wanted to have the entire U.S., you know, experience an eclipse, then basically over 1,000 years, every point sees an eclipse at, you know, at some point, right? But, of course, never all at once.
And what will you be doing on the day of the total solar eclipse?
Well, I'm going to be hoping for good weather, and I'm going to make a pinhole camera too, and then we'll see how it works out.
Thanks to UD astronomy professor Dr. John Gieses and R. Katie Pikus for their time this week. We turn now to our History Matters segment and historic preservation. A number of historic buildings, from the Thomas England House to Somerton Mansion in Middletown, have been demolished in recent months. Historic preservation advocates are rallying to change that, and Nonprofit Preservation Delaware is willing to help organize such efforts in the first state. Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly sat down with the group's executive director, James Hamby.
So tell me about your vision for the organization.
Well, I'd like to see Preservation Delaware become what its organizing really was supposed to be about, which is a statewide organization for historic preservation. It used to be. It kind of fell back off of that, and so we're working on rebuilding and hopefully through meetings like this, bringing folks out that are interested in historic preservation and are concerned about the loss of our historic fabric, we can get back up to speed and be that statewide organization for historic preservation, education, and advocacy across the state.
When do you think it really kind of fell out of its mission a little bit?
Yeah, probably... It started when, and I'm not sure of exactly what year it occurred, but they acquired the Gibraltar property up in Wilmington and the gardens attached. And there's a lot of time, effort, and money involved in owning a property. And that really took away from its statewide mission because it then became all about Gibraltar. And so we no longer own the mansion. We still own the gardens, which do require a bit of upkeep, but there is a committee that deals with that. And so we're hoping that with a rebuilt board of directors, we can reach out to across the state and hold workshops, you know, speak with our elected officials and just be a force for historic preservation that's missing a voice.
Within kind of the education piece and the advocacy arena, what are some specific things that you hope to work on?
Just making people aware of the resources that are available to them. For businesses, making them aware of the tax credits that are available for historic preservation, both from the state and the federal level. For private property owners, just making them aware of, you know, there are grants and things that are available to help them over the hump if they're looking at a project that they think is maybe a little too big for them. And also just folks that can help them in understanding how to do the projects that they are. One of the things Preservation Delaware did in the past was they held in each of the counties workshops on how to care for historic windows, things like that. Windows can be one of the biggest expenses if you own a historic property because of the heat loss and also in the summertime keeping air conditioning in. And so being able to help people figure out how they can inexpensively preserve their historic windows. They don't have to go tear all the historic windows out and put in new windows, which really destroys the fabric of the building. You know, it was an important thing that they did, but we haven't done it in years. The case of the house that was down in the Middletown area that was on the Historic Review Board agenda, the folks were really there for demolition permit because they didn't know what else to do. That's sad. We should be there to be able to explain to them, maybe you want to do this, maybe you want to do that, and help them through that process. And ultimately, they may have ended up at the board for a demolition permit, but they would have tried a bunch of other stuff first.
And in terms of advocacy, you had written some, is it county code, to try and get Newcastle County to change their ways a little bit in terms of how they review properties for demolition?
Sure. I had used some language out of a Connecticut historic preservation ordinance, which just ensured that the public had adequate input in the process before a historic home was approved for demolition. It's lacking sometimes now in Newcastle County. It's even more lacking elsewhere in the state. As the Thomas England House taught us, there really wasn't any public meeting or anything for anybody to weigh in on. And so my code amendment for Newcastle County would have required that they post the demolition permits on their website for a period of time and would have allowed any member of the public or any member of the Historic Review Board to say they thought it was historic. And if they did, then it would at least get a hearing at the Historic Review Board. right now, the County Historic Preservation Planner goes out, looks at it. If he or she thinks it doesn't meet any of the criteria, they can sign off on it, and the demolition permit never goes to the Historic Review Board, never gets a public hearing, and then people find out about it, and maybe they bring to light information the Historic Preservation Planner didn't know. And so we feel when you're dealing with historic properties, they should at least get a public hearing. And that's all we're really looking for, is the ability to, for the public to speak and weigh in on really their county.
Historically, has the organization kind of met with developers and kind of helped them through the process of potentially restoring a building?
Not that I'm aware of, but I think it's something that is missing, because at least, like I say, in Newcastle County, there is a density bonus for historic preservation that, if it ever was used, I'm not aware of it. And so we need to ask why. And who can we ask why that would know better than the developers that don't use it? So why not sit down with them and say, what do you think would make it more likely that you would preserve a historic property? Are there other incentives that would work better? And maybe there's not. Maybe there's not any dealing with them. But I think that there is. I think there's some middle ground. As someone else says, if it's in their financial interest, they'll do it. And so we just need to figure out what that trigger is.
How many, do you know how many homes or how many historic properties have been demolished last several months?
It depends on who you ask. At least four or five that we've lost probably in the last 4 to 6 months in between Kent and Newcastle County that we're aware of. It certainly is part of what we hope will be the outgrowth of this group, is having folks throughout the state that are communicating, so we know if these things are threatened, or we know if it's occurred in other places, because right now something could happen in Western Sussex County and we may not even know about it. So, you know, it's really important that all of us that are interested throughout the state are communicating and forming that network to really be advocates across the whole state, not just in certain areas that are strong in historic preservation.
Sounds like you're going to be the umbrella organization, perhaps.
We hope. We hope. We hope that folks will decide that Preservation Delaware is the vehicle to move that forward throughout the state. That's what its mission was, and we hope that that's what folks will decide can be, again, the mission.
Thanks to our Megan Pauly and Preservation Delaware's James Hanby for their time. And The Green continues momentarily with our second roundtable discussion with a handful of young African leaders at UD this summer as part of a nationwide fellowship program. Stick around. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This summer, 25 young African leaders from various countries attended a summer institute on civic leadership at the University of Delaware, part of the U.S. State Department program called the Mandela Washington Fellowship. Last week, we heard from a handful of them. This week, R. Megan Pauly sits down with another group to discuss issues they're working to address in their home countries, like media censorship and women's rights. Rita is a teacher and radio host in Ghana. Rahami is a freelance journalist and peace builder in Mali. Sefin is a media professional and works with widows in Nigeria. And Adams is an environmentalist and writer in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Here's their conversation.
First of all, just wanted to see if you could just introduce yourself and where you're from.
Thank you for having us. My name is Sefin Smart from Nigeria. I run a foundation called the Smart Sisters Foundation. We empower widows through skill acquisition training, starting them off on a small-scale business of some sort, that they will become financially independent, take care of themselves and their dependents. We also send young girls to school alongside educating them beyond the four walls of a classroom.
I am Rahama Nantume. I'm from Mali. I'm a journalist, peace worker. I also do research about youth radicalization and violence extremism, how to prevent it and counter it in North Park and center of Mali.
My name is Adams Kasinga. I am an environmentalist, currently focusing on wildlife conservation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I run an NGO called Conserve Congo. We aim to preserve the Congo Basin biodiversity. We do that by promoting scientific tourism, fighting poaching, promoting conservation through education, as well as ensuring food security.
My name is Rita Siam from Ghana. I'm a teacher by profession, and I run three radio shows. And I am the founder of Feminine Star Africa, an NGO which is into improving education in the rural areas and also empowering women through skills training and small-scale business support, where we give women little capitals for them to be able to start their own businesses for self-reliance.
Since several of you have journalism experience, I was just hoping that, Rita, you could touch on, first of all, the radio host work that you're doing.
Okay, I host three radio programs. One is Health is Wealth, which simply discusses health issues. We interview doctors, nurses, and all health workers on issues that affect everybody from diabetes to preventive health. And I also have the second program, which is a Sunday morning show, Best Wishes. It's simply a program where we connect families and friends together. We get them to say sorry when they go wrong or do something bad, and also appreciate their families when they do good things. They also use the opportunity to send regards and greetings, which is basically, it's a music program and people call in and shared love on air. The third program is CyPlat. It's cohesive youth platform put together into the word CyPlat. It's simply to educate the youth on all issues affecting them, from relationship, education, career building, to how they can make their life better. So we bring resource persons who have made it in their lives, who have been through thick and thin. They share their personal experiences to also inspire this youth who listen to us.
And Rahama, tell me a little bit more about your work as a journalist and some of the challenges in your home country.
I will start by speaking about my commitment in peacekeeping mission. Because of the crisis which happened in 2012 in Mali, so I lost some relative. And it's not only my story, it's the story of a youth Malian, because it's a youth from 15 to 13 who have been involved in violence and terrorist group. So as a youth, I have been concerned. So this is why I decided to focus about how to prevent youth radicalization and how to give better life to those who have been involved and want to come back to the society. It's difficult from communities, for example, back home in my country. In the community, we have trust issue. We live together. But when you betray the communities by doing an act, it's difficult for them to forgive you, to forget about what happened. So what I'm trying to do is to sensitize community. Because I'm a journalist, so it's my duty to maintain peace or to have peace in my country as journalist, as Malian, as youth. So I do it through sometimes sensitization to the communities. I do it by advocacy to have a legislator to vote a law. And I do it through education, organize a focus group, a debate between the communities where the conflict is, to come to sit down to talk about what's happened and to talk about how to forgive what's happened, how to accept ourselves in our diversities and how to go ahead. Because my work should not be only to say an attack happened in which part and we lost only this person.
Sure. Have you had any pushback in terms of censorship?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's happened in my country. Many people have been arrested since 2012 until 2015. Authority forgot about them. So I decided to realize a documentary movie about this, and it really caused me many, many damage. Because I spent 3 months when I went to the Ministry in charge of defense or security, they will say it's not our duty. There is a place in charge of jail, go there. When I go there, they will say, no, go there. So I spent many time to meet people, to discuss with them. Many trying to discourage me. Even one time my mom said, it's enough. I don't want you to lose your time or to lose your life because of this, because my mom have only me. So one time, I remember one sentence shocked me. When I met a authority. He said, ah, it's you, Rama. I said, yes, because I received your letter and some people called me to say that you want to realize this movie. I said, yes. And when he asked me why, I gave him my answer. And then he said, okay, I will just ask you one question. Are you sure that you love your country? I was shocked. I said, oh, why should I answer to this question? He said, no, because until now we are in process of peace. If I should realize a movie to show to the world that the authorities has violated human rights in my country, can you imagine what damage will you cause? And then when he finished, I said, maybe today you will not give me the authorization to do that. But remember, I will not give up this project.
And Adams, I know that you you aren't a journalist now. You're doing speaking, but you were a journalist. And I was hoping you could just touch on that and then also share about your work now.
All right. One of my mentors as a journalist once told me that being a journalist is not a profession. It is a lifestyle. If you have been once a journalist, always you'll have that tendency. And even though I'm doing something different now, but they say that my journalism background is of great essence to what I am doing right now, especially when I have to do a lot of sensitizing, public speaking, trying to get the world aware of the situation back home. You have to be able to write a lot. You have to be able to speak a lot, and you cannot speak about something you did not write. And that's journalism. So just to give a bit of a background, I was a reporter for about 5 years. I worked with a huge organization in South Africa called Caxton, the Caxton Group. I wrote for a weekly newspaper called the Lofelder, and I tackled a number of issues. We were based in a mining town, so one of our focus was environmental issues, and I did a lot of environmental investigations. We focused on false insurance claims and other socioeconomic issues, including the story about initiation schools. It is a big issue. And after I got aggressed, the law, because of that incident, to date in the province of Mpumalanga in eastern South Africa, the law was changed that every initiation school should now have a permit. And should it be found not in the possession of a valid permit, it shuts down and people are going to be taken before the court of law, where they will be answerable to their deeds.
I understand you were involved in an investigative story and were actually shot at several times. Could you just tell us a little bit about that story? And
this was one early morning in a newsroom. An old lady comes. She was about 70-something years of age, and she was really distraught. And her complaint was that her 12-year-old grandson had left home without her permission, and she went to an initiation school. This is a boy who grew up without parents. And sometimes as an African child, you feel that father figure is very important for you to have that identity. So a lot of children tend to go there in search of a father figure, where they're going to transform you into a man overnight. So the boy had left and embraced a certain school where there were about 70 or 80 of them. But unfortunately, after 1 week, the grandmother received bad news that the child had died. Now, she told me that the child apparently was in good health. She even brought photographs. The child has never complained of any headache, but suddenly the child died overnight. And she asked me, would you please help me find out what really happened? At the time, I had my colleague, and he was the photographer. His name was Teddy Ndlazi. We drove about 50 kilometers out of town. It was in a rural area, so we parked the vehicle on top of a hill and went down into the valley where the school was. And when we reached there, the first person I came across wonders that I don't think you and cameras are going to be allowed into the school. So the best way would be for you to stay here and wait while I go and call the responsible person to speak with you. So at that particular time, we waited, we sat down. We waited for about an hour, and here comes the guy. He was an older guy in his 70s. He was very unhappy to see us. But I guess he kept his cool, and he said, yeah, let's go home and have a chat about this, which was not far from the area where we were. We walked home, and when we reached his house, we started talking. So I asked him a few questions, and he told me this is not a media, it's not a media campaign. Mm. This is our traditions, and you are not going to change it today just because you're from the media. The child died. He died of natural causes. And that's all we know. Then I said, but the hospital has got to certify that. It's not up to you. And apparently, the hospital is claiming that there must have been foul play. Mm. Now, he did not like that. So he went into the house, and suddenly he came out with a pistol. It must have been like a revolver, a .22 caliber. And as he pointed it, Teddy was fast enough, and he went up the mountain. I thought he was just threatening. Until he fired once.
Wow.
Then I turned around and I started going uphill. Then I dropped my camera. As I turned around to pick the camera, he fired three more times consecutively.
Wow.
I picked the camera and I started to run about 5 meters, I collapsed. So I had been shot twice in the legs and one grazed my head. So I just saw blood gushing from everywhere. And I was there, thank God, for Teddy to escape. So Teddy alerted the newsroom, and the newsroom called the state police, which alerted the ambulance, and they came flying. But it took too long because they could not locate exactly where we were. Only 4 hours later, they located us, but I had already passed out. So I was put into the ambulance and rushed to the hospital, where I spent about 1 week in coma. A week later, 25 of the guys in the initiation schools were arrested. And I was called to come and identify them. So it was a very traumatic moment at the time, coming face to face with the same people who had maltreated me so badly. But I managed to identify all 25 of them. They were remanded in custody. And I remember just a few weeks, I think it's 2 or 3, from the day I got shot, my father was supposed to have come to visit me. We had not seen each other in like 6 years. So he wasn't really happy. And the advice he gave me, he said, look, you could have died. And I think now you're putting your life in more danger. Well, against my own wish, because I wanted to honor my father's word, I'd go and say, you know, I don't think I'll be able to pursue the case. If you can continue prosecuting it on your own, it's fine, but I'll not come again and testify out of fear. And that was the end of my journalism career, or active journalism career.
Sure.
And I didn't know what to do next.
But you were still able to tell that story, right? You said laws were changed.
At that particular moment, my story attracted a lot of media frenzy. And the Minister for Traditional Affairs came to pay me a visit while in hospital. And once I went back home from the hospital, he came again. And we had a one-on-one interaction where he wanted to know my views on what should be done. And I thought that if there could be a law which can be able to regulate such schools, then we can be able to hold somebody accountable. And in that very same year, 2006, a law was passed at provincial level that anybody who would have any need, be it a traditional leader or a traditional healer, who wants to run a traditional school, they have to come to government and apply for a special permit. If you do not have that permit, then you could be prosecuted by a court of law. And I took it in a positive way, that even though it was a negative and unfortunate incident, but at least it turned out to have an impact on the legislation.
Thank you for sharing. That's a very powerful story. And Sefin, you work with women in Nigeria, and just wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about some of the cultural taboos and issues that women face.
Widows are maltreated. Widows are demonized. Widows are suppressed and oppressed when they lose their husbands. It's bad enough that a widow can be allowed to or mandated to sit on the floor, on the bare floor, for the duration of the mourning process of her husband. In the Yoruba culture, a woman is sometimes mandated to sleep on the cobs or the graveyard where the husband has been buried, you know. In some cases, the woman's hair is shaved. She can't wash her body for a long duration, even if she's on her period. She must go on like that, sometimes for 7 days, and then wash up properly. So there's so many oppressions and suppressions that the widow suffers in the hands of her relatives when the man is gone. It's worse off that the inheritance of the man is taken away from the woman. No consideration is put on our contribution onto what they have as a family, you know. And sometimes she's driven out of the house with her kids, and it doesn't matter the number of kids that they have. And so with Smart Sisters Foundation, which is the foundation that I started 7 years ago, although at the moment I play the role of the programs person, it's become a teamwork. Part of what we do is we acknowledge the plights of those widows, and we try as much as possible in our own little way to empower them, restore that sense of hope that just because your man is gone doesn't mean that you can't keep going on. And just because some people have ganged up and tried as much as possible to steal your joy away, as long as you're alive, you can still be whatever you want to be. Like, it's not too late to be what you want to be. And so we'd have widows who their husbands have just died, widows who their husbands, it's been a long time, you know, and we would train them, try and find out what their passion is, what they still feel like they can do. And for some of them, it's like an opportunity to finally get back either to school or to a business of some sort. And the amazing thing is the amount of money that the woman requires is really not massive. A woman can require just $20 to actually start up a business that would sustain her and our dependence for a long duration. So when we bring our widows together, when we go to rural communities and we try as much as possible to train them, one very important aspect to it is the psychological aspect to it. A lot of the times we bring various widows from various communities because no other person will be able to understand the plight of a widow than another widow. And so there is that networking psychological release when they share with each other. And just talk about their pains and their struggles and how they use both unorthodox and orthodox ways to ensure they keep on going at it, you know. And when it comes to the money, yes, you know, we can give them. And that's a part of what we do. And for the younger girls, we run a project called the Edu Child, paying tuition that she can go to school. Alongside She Needs to Know. She Needs to Know is highly symbolic for us because we believe that every young girl must know, must have the basic skills, basic knowledge, basic information to be able to have the right knowledge, basic foundation, to be able to make the right decision, to become that vibrant, great woman. Some of us, all the ones who say, if we'd known, we probably would never have made that mistake, you know, but to our younger girls, we say there's still the opportunity to start to do right from that early stage, that in terms of what you want to be, as a young girl, you can grow up being that. Just because the circumstances where your parents can afford to send you to school is crippling, it shouldn't be a setback of some sort. And so we try to bridge that gap, that she goes to school and yet she's empowered in everything, education-wise, life skills, the whole bunch.
Do you feel like the narratives of those widows are being told in the media?
There is a sense of it's a man's world. And so information being passed in the media is still not balanced. There is not enough coverage of what really the widow is going through. And there should be that sense of more publicity on that. Some women are still not comfortable having to tell their stories. And so you look for alternative ways where they can tell their story. I mean, you've got to create credibility from when the sister is the one telling the story. But you probably would need to blur the person's face to protect the sister who's sharing that story. For some people, they have successfully passed that barricade, that bridge of saying, I can speak up, I've gone through it, and nothing can stop me, nobody's holding me back, and I would say it irrespective of the circumstances. It's a work in progress, having to get women to actually share their story and share their pain as it is.
Yeah, so what have you learned your time here that you really would like to apply back home?
My name is Sefin Smart. I'm founder of Smart Sisters Foundation and Programs Persons for our projects. It's been amazing. It's been a privilege, you know, that I got to come to America. And this is my first time. I have been privileged enough to listen to a lot of facilitators, been involved in a lot of sessions. There's a renewed sense of how I perceive things, how I see things, a new sort of renewed passion of what I am about, what I started.
Rahama Nantume from Mali, journalist, peace worker. For me, I really learned a lot from different culture, different people, different skills. And what I really appreciate here is the feeling of patriotism. It's really amazing here sometimes. One funny thing, when I went to Philadelphia, I was passing and then automatically I saw American flag in the cemetery. I said, oh, back home in my country, we have flag during our Independence Day or special occasion. It's not everywhere. Even here, even people have a flag in front of their house. I really appreciate this feeling of patriotism here.
Yes, my name is Adams Kasinga. I am from the Congo. Coming here, meeting with another 24 colleagues from 20 different countries, that is one of the highlights. It's like Africa meeting Africa away from Africa. And I'm sure more than half of us would agree with me that it's their first time or one of those rare occasions where we meet like this as Africans.
Yes.
Debating, discussing on issues affecting all of us. But I was particularly impressed with the patriotism, just like my colleague just said. Americans love America. Mm-hmm. And they do not make a secret out of it. It even make me doubt my patriotism. I think I have to try harder. And if I can sensitize more people back home to love our country the same way Americans love their country, we can make a difference. Secondly, there's a point, no job is a small job in America. Back home, we have jobs that are considered small. In America, there's no small job. Everybody earns respect for what they do, and they take what they do seriously.
For me, the fact that my experience here has exposed me to the good, bad, and ugly side of America. I met people who were extremely very rich. Yes, I met people who were like middle class. And I met people who were sleeping literally on the streets begging. And that has opened my mind. And I've realized that, hey, Africa is not perfect, but it's not perfect here either. So if we can rather stay back home and invest into our own lives by using our own resources, then I think it's worth it than to just like leave your home to US when you have nothing at hand, or like get in the country illegally when you have nothing to do. It will be very, very hard for you to survive on the streets if you have no money, because I feel like those people are begging, they don't have money, so they can't eat. That's what I've seen in the system. And one thing I've also realized is there is this great spirit or sense of like volunteerism and community building. I've realized that the smaller regions or areas or communities in your country are developing because of this sense of commitment to community development. People come out in their numbers to volunteer. People, give out their all to volunteer. We've been to
Project Cure.
We've been to Sojourner's Home and places like that. And people literally leave their homes to come there to volunteer. And one thing I've also realized is that back at home, our system is such a way that we don't have any local income. Taxes are taken from up there. So before a tax, any of our money which we contribute come down there for us to use it to develop our community, it's very difficult. So what is happening here is like the tax are collected locally, and then you guys sit down and then decide what projects we want to do and where we want to handle. And that is fantastic. You can find that in my country. And I think it is something I have to take back. And I meet highly qualified professional people, very rich, and they are so humble to the level that, like, the dean of this particular school, oh, my God, she's so simple. And she shared her time with me and talked with me as if I'm her equal. Back in my country, you won't have that. We met with people that we would call MP, the senators. We met with Senator Coombs. We met him, and he was the simplest person I've ever met. In Ghana, you would not even see your MP in a day. I mean, in a day, to even have an hour with him, that is no-go area. For you to ever meet him, it's like just when he is coming for campaign. That is the only time you get to see him or get to talk with him or get to meet him. And another thing I've realized is your education system. I am a teacher, and relating this back home to what I know, we teach just like theory. That is it. We don't have the resources, I know about that, yes. But teaching is more like theory. But here, I went to that Kingswood Community Center where we had kids having summer class, just summer class. And they were able to build a robot. I was like, what? I was shocked. This is a situation where kids get to learn practical way of doing things. A child can just get that idea from there, start building robots as a baby. Mm-hmm. By the time that child grows up, the child can build a whole community of robots or an airplane or whatever. And that is not happening in my country. I feel so sad about that. I want to take that back home and make a change in education. And for me, I realize that you guys have this kind of social services that you provide in your communities. We don't have any of that. And coming here, even though I was looking at just education and women empowerment, it has broadened my scope. I'm thinking of go back there, build my center of empowerment in general, where we'll provide social services in there for women, children, for abused girls and women. And at the same time, we set up our various community. We should start having community farms, which I read on some website that they have community farms. We don't have any of such thing. They should have a community center where people can come in there, have their problems solved. So I'm going back home to improve my community in general. I want to instill in them that communal, the heart for the community. Develop your own community. Don't wait for the government to come and make the change. You make the change yourself. That is what I am taking back home.
Thanks to our Megan Pauly and the Mandela Fellows. You can hear more of this conversation at DelawarePublic.org, where you'll also find full bios of these fellows, including those you didn't hear from today. And that's a wrap on The Green for this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly and Katie Pikus. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.